another edition of the Sensitive Skin Magazine podcast. I'm your host, Bernard Meisler. I'm the editor-in-chief of Sensitive Skin Magazine. And our guest today is my old pal, Norman Douglas. I've known Norman for over 50 years. I doubt that I'll ever interview anybody on this podcast that I've known longer than Norman. To give you an idea how old we met, we were playing hide and seek. Turns out his dad was friends with one of my friend's moms. I won't go into any more detail about that. His dad was actually my dermatologist when I was a spotty teenager. We ended up meeting again in New York in our early 20s when he was roommates with some college pals of mine. And we figured out that we knew each other. It was like, oh, do you know, you're from Rhode Island? I'm from Rhode Island, too. And then we figured out that we'd met when we were kids and just knew all sorts of people in common. Norman's also one of the original co-founders of Sensitive Skin back when it was known as Poisson Siebel. We did a few issues together. We had a falling out. I kicked his ass to the curb, renamed it Sensitive Skin. As I've told him, I don't regret having parted ways with him at that point, but I wish I'd done it a little more gracefully. But then again, I didn't do a whole lot of things very gracefully before the age of 35 or so. But I've apologized to him about it, and I'll do it again. Sorry about that, Norman. At any rate, we've become friends again over the years. Bygones are bygones, although we don't see each other too much because we live thousands of miles away. I'm in California. I'm not sure where he is now. You'll hear where he is during the podcast. At any rate, Norman says he's not a poet, although this is the reason why I wanted to release this podcast during Poetry Week, because he was, for a while in New York, he was writing poems on the street, and he tells some stories about that. He'd write poems on demand. He had a little stand set up and a typewriter, and people would come up and make requests, and he'd just bang out a poem on his typewriter. He also says he's not a writer because he doesn't make any money at it. That's one way of looking at it, although he does read us a short story at about the 49-minute mark. Please make sure to listen to that. He talks about some of his earliest influences, which he claims is the book Stuart Little. And his first major publication, something else we have in common, was for him, it was a letter in X-Men number 12. For me, it was Tomb of Dracula number 11. And luckily, these are old issues, hard to find and expensive, so you won't be able to see our incredibly embarrassing letters we wrote when we were kids. And speaking of comic books, we spoke a little bit about the recent death of Stan Lee. This was actually recorded a few months ago, and I was holding it back for a number of reasons, but I'm releasing it now. And that's also, I talked about the fires in California and stuff like that. At any rate, we had a good time talking, as we always do. So here is my conversation with Norman Douglas. How are you, man?
Yeah, I'm okay. How you doing?
Yeah, you know, living that dream.
What dream?
The all-American dream. Yeah. French fries, apple pie, Chevrolet, LSD, all that stuff.
Yeah. I wish I could still take some LSD.
Yeah. You know, there's lots of people, lots of people messing around with it these days and microdosing and stuff like that. And I would be tempted if I knew I could get pure pharmaceutical shit. But, you know,
if I knew Albert Hoffman was making it, I'd do it.
Yeah, there you go. You know, I took a hit of Red Dragon acid in 1979, and I'm still waiting to come down from that from that shit.
I took some mushrooms this summer, and I'm still waiting to get high.
Oh, really? So where are you? Where are you located right now?
Today I'm in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Oh, really? Is that your mom's house?
No, she's in Virginia Beach.
Okay. Who's in Chapel Hill?
I'm working on a house here.
Oh, okay.
I'm like becoming an itinerant carpenter.
Oh, well, there you go. As long as you got some skills, it's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. better than me, washed up computer programmer.
Yeah, I know. I'm washed up computer user. I'm down to I got an HP.
Oh man,
got an HP and a LG G4. It at least takes two SIM cards, but I subscribe to some stupid online service that's like the worst in the world.
What do they push ads on you and shit?
They don't do anything. It's like I don't get any service unless I'm like standing under a cell tower. And then it comes up with a screen that says log in for data. And so I hit the screen and then it freezes. What the fuck?
But you're in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Where are you hanging your hat regularly? You're someplace upstate, or?
Yeah, I was doing that up there. Same thing, working on a guy's house. He was pretending to be my benefactor, but the more I worked, the less he was my benefactor.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. Ain't that the way?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just like trying to figure it out.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm gonna.
Yeah.
I like had a big dust up with Carlo early in the year.
Because I had this great McCormick?
Altamari.
Oh, Carlo. Altamari. Oh, really? What happened?
He was like, I came up with this ingenious idea to like make some money for this book project that somebody else started, but I was a part of. And then, Carlo was basically like, dude, you're never going to get any money unless you look like you don't need any money. And I was like, that's bullshit. But now it's starting to fucking ring true.
Yeah, I think he has a point. It's like, you know, it's like people who need to get a loan, right? It's like the bank will only give you a loan if you can prove you have a lot of money.
Yeah.
Right.
And then, but regular folks are like that too, you know? Just like this guy, you know? It's sort of like, I was just talking one day. I wasn't asking anybody for anything. I was at this other guy's art opening. And he's like, what are you up to? And I was like, oh, I don't know. I said, I want to go to a monastery and write or something somewhere out in the country. So this other guy is standing there. He's like, I got a house. I'm going to use it. It's upstate. You can stay there. I was like, oh. I was like, really? So I think I'm checking this guy out for like, I'm looking at stuff to read for later. That's why I'm like not looking at it. But of course, you know.
So are you getting any work done at least?
Carpentry work or writing work?
Writing work.
I got a lot of work done up there. Got a lot of first draft for a book. Short stories.
There you go.
But, the longer I stayed there, the more he started sweating me, and the more it became apparent that his,
wasn't pure charity on his part.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it was kind of like, it was once he patted himself on the back, then, you know, he broke his arm and he got mad at me, and it was kind of like, what the fuck?
Yeah, yeah.
One of those kind of things. I don't know. So, be that as it may, I'm kind of in the same situation now, and I'm kind of waiting for the axe to fall down here. I don't know. I kind of, like, haven't been especially savvy when it comes to life skills. In late capitalist America.
I think we're past late capitalism. I mean, that's how fucked up stuff is now, right? It's like it's not even fascist. I mean, capitalism anyway. It's just pure fascism. I mean, it's corporate oligarchy and oligopoly and all that shit, you know?
Well, I mean, the one thing I have learned I can pat myself on the back for is that I really don't talk politics anymore. You can believe it.
That's good.
Because I was like, definitely that was not making me any friends.
Well, you know, it's like, what's the point, you know? It's just like,
it's like talking about somebody you don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's just like you can, like, you know, badmouth Trump unless the person happens to be a Trump supporter, in which case you lose a friend, which is probably fine. Or, you know, or if they're a liberal lefty, you'll get into, like, you know, you'll start, like, slicing and dicing, and it's just like, you know, what? Yeah. You don't believe in democratic socialism? No, I'm a social democrat. You know, it's gets silly pretty quickly.
The last, I was like, you know, my last argument was always like, okay, so we're going to punish these guys. You're going to be the jailer? You're going to be the executioner? Who's going to do this job? It's like, you don't like the prison system, but you want to throw people in prison. I don't get it.
that's a good point.
You don't like cops, but you still want good cops. What are you talking about?
Right, right. The good cops are the ones who are on my side. Yeah, whatever. Yeah, it's true. And of course, you know, whenever I get into a political discussion with somebody, I make my points as clearly and cogently as I can, and their mind changes. You know, they end up agreeing with me, and, you know, I shake their hand, and I've converted someone to my ideas. It works every time. You know,
that's why I got off of Facebook. Fucking take it.
Facebook is, you know, I'm still on Facebook, even though I hate it, just because it's, you know, my friends are scattered over the face of the earth, like literally all over the fucking planet at this point. And it's the only way I get to, you know, keep in touch with people. So, but it's a fucking cesspool.
Yeah, I realized I could be on Messenger. So most people I can talk to can actually make, like, it's as good as this. You can make, like, video chats.
Oh, yeah.
All overseas and everything like that for free.
I refuse to get on Messenger and WhatsApp because, you know, that's how they get you. Yeah.
Yeah. But you're not on but I'm not on Facebook, so they don't send me any ads.
Oh.
Well, actually, I don't know. I got ad blocker on my computer. I guess that if I use my phone, there's not that many.
Yeah.
It's not that bad.
Yeah. All right. So anyway, let's go back to the beginning. You were born in somewhere. where'd you grow up? Let's get started with that.
What do you mean? I grew up down the road from you. What are you talking about?
Yeah, no. I know. So
I grew up in
for our podcast listeners, I should, full disclosures, I strongly doubt I will ever interview, ever, no matter how many of these I ever end up doing or how long I do it, I will ever interview anyone that I have known longer than Norman. To give you an idea, I think the first time we met, we were playing hide and go seek.
Yeah, probably so, like 10 years old or something like that.
Something like that.
So, I was born on 9/11 in 1959 in Walter Reed Army Hospital. And but my old man quickly moved to New Haven so he could finish up his residency at Yale. And then he was on the faculty there. They got cannibalized. We moved to Rhode Island when I was 9.
Yeah. And I hate to ask, but is your dad still alive? I haven't asked you in a while. He's still going? Okay.
He's alive. He's got Alzheimer's.
That's too bad.
Did the prostate ripped him up, all that shit.
Oh, man. I'm sorry to hear that.
But he retired. He was 81 when he retired. They kind of were like, dude, I think it's time for you to go now.
Another fun fact, Norman's dad was my dermatologist as an acne-ridden teenager.
So, yeah, he's okay.
Yeah.
Mom's, he's alive, and his wife is 15, 20 years younger than him, so she's taking care of him.
That's good.
And then Mom's down in Old Virginia. She's totally healthy. Well, she was healthier. She's in her 80s also, but there's nothing wrong with her, but except that her husband was in the military and he got whatever that asbestos thing is. Something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Messed up fucking defense industry shit.
Oh, man.
And so he's been messed up for like 15 years, and so she's been taking care of him, and, you know, he's in and out of the hospital, so it's kind of starting to wear on her now. It's starting to wear on her a few years ago, so.
Wow. My wife has express instructions for me, like if I ever go down like the Alzheimer's route, I'm like, you ever see that movie, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest? Remember how that ended? Yeah. Do me a favor. Do yourself a favor. Just put the fucking pillow over my head, you know?
Yeah, let me put that out there for all those listeners, whoever I may be with. Pull the plug.
Yeah.
Don't even plug me in.
Don't even plug me in. Yeah, just make it, or pretend by accident you kick the plug out of the wall, right? Yeah. Yeah. So you grew up in Rhode Island, and so what is it that made you start getting into art or writing, or when did that? What were your like earliest influences? I'm gonna, before you even answer, I'll say for me, I've been thinking about it because Stan Lee died the other day. And
yeah, yeah.
I know lots of people have mixed feelings about him, especially people who work in the comic book industry and feel, you know, he cheated a lot of people. He stole Jack Kirby.
Yeah, don't bring up his name to James Romberger.
Yeah, exactly. but at the same time, I'll give him credit because he was an editor and he got all those guys published. And he, you know, and anyway, for me, that was my first exposure to I call it high art, was like Jack Kirby and Steranko and that stuff. So but I don't know, what enough about me.
Yeah, I think for me it was more like I think it was my mom reading to me. She was good at it, so I'd have to go back to Richard Scarry's Busy Busy World.
Okay.
Because she used to do the reading, and she'd do the voices, and she'd remember them. She did like a million little
nice
voices and everything, and she was like really good at it. So, and then I'm pretty sure the first novel I ever read on my own was Stuart Little.
Mm-hmm.
No, although the first book I probably read on my own was Winnie the Pooh, but it's not really a novel. It's kind of like a compendium of short stories.
Okay. First book without pictures, right?
Was Stuart Little. But yeah. Stuart Little had pictures too.
I'm not sure. I don't remember.
I read early on, I think the first book I ever read without pictures, right around that time, I don't know how, because it was laying around the house, was Ivan Ho by Tennyson.
Really? I had an abridged copy of that when I was a little kid too. That's funny.
I had a little hardcover. I was like, I guess it was my mother's probably, because she studied literature.
Yeah.
I think teaching,
I think English. It's funny that I remember this. The first quote unquote novel I read was an adaptation of Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. You know, just like, and but I was a young reader, and I started when I was like seven or something. I started reading Edgar Rice Burroughs and Jules Verne, H. Rider Haggard.
I mean, those books I probably read in first grade. Yeah, by second, third grade, I was into the sword and sorcery, science fiction, Michael Moorcock, Harlan Ellison, Isaac Asimov, all that stuff.
Arthur Conan Doyle,
Arthur C. Clarke.
Yeah, yeah.
Edgar Rice Burroughs, Robert E. Howard, all that stuff. I think then it was Catch 22.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first grown-up novel I read. I was probably like 10 years old. And then about that time, maybe a year or two before that, was the comic books. Like you say, Marvel only, never DC. And then...
Every once in a while, I'll meet somebody and we start talking about comic books, like growing up when we were kids. And then they'll start saying, yeah, I love DC. And I'm like, oh, I can't even. You know, you just lost me. You're a DC guy? Come on. You know?
Yeah. Talking about comic books here. But, yeah, and then the other big encouragement, I got two things published in Scholastic magazine. Two poems. Remember that Scholastic weekly thing, whatever it was, or monthly? I got two published in there. And then I got a letter published in X-Men number 12.
Oh, all right. I will have to like try to find. That's pretty early. Somebody called me out recently because they said you had a letter published in Tomb of Dracula number 11, didn't you? It's like, oh, fuck. I knew somebody was going to find that one of these days. Yeah.
It was pretty horrible.
Yeah.
I think mine was pretty bad, too. I think as soon as it came out, I was like, woohoo, they published my letter. And then it came out. I was like, did I write that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I swear to this day that they, like, heavily edited it to the point where it was, like, not even my letter anymore.
Yeah, but I was like, how fucking thrilled were you when you got that letter from Marvel Comics? Oh, my God.
Probably saved that letter longer than I saved the acceptance letter longer than I saved my own letter. And then I just read all kinds of stuff, you know, after that. Oh, Vonnegut. Did I say Vonnegut?
Nope. That was
Catch 22. And then I exhausted the Vonnegut canon through Breakfast of Champions.
Uh-huh.
I think the first one I read was Cat's Cradle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read all that was big for me in high school too. All the Vonnegut stuff, Slaughterhouse Five.
And I got to say, I loved The Once and Future King in high school by E.B. White about King Arthur.
Mm-hmm.
And because it was, you know, I thought it was, and then I read a lot of Twain, Mark Twain.
Mm-hmm. Not Shania Twain, Mark Twain.
Who?
Never mind. I'm just fucking with you.
And then, that's a writer, Shania Twain?
She's a country music star.
Oh, yeah. And then, I don't know, after that, I don't know when I got into... Then my brother had a copy of Trout Fishing in America.
Oh, yeah.
And then it was all downhill from there.
Yeah, everybody was reading that back then.
I was like in love with that. And then he had a copy of The Abortion by Brodigan.
Mm.
That was like, and then I read Steal This Book. He had a lot of it was my older brother's books. I'd be like, mm-hmm. What's he got here? Steal This Book by Abby Hoffman, Do It by Jerry Rubin, Die Nigger Die, Soul on Ice.
Oh, nice.
All that stuff. Can't say that I read a whole lot of poetry other than, even Baraka. He's probably the first poet. Sonia Sanchez, I remember liking back then, but I never read and I never got into anything like, you know, Malcolm X, the autobiography of Malcolm X. That was like, definitely.
Mm-hmm. And when did you get serious about wanting to write? And, you know, and who was the, like, all that stuff is great, but was there anyone in particular that made you think, like, I want to do this? Or
probably Stuart Little.
Uh-huh, okay.
I started writing stupid little stories back then, way back when I was a kid.
All right, that's funny.
I remember I wrote my first novel when I was 11 years old. It was called Super Amalgamated Freeze-Dried Horseshit.
Nice.
No, it was called New Improved Super Amalgamated Freeze-Dried Horseshit.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It was kind of like a Patty Hearst kind of thing. It was like based on that whole Patty Hearst Symbionese Liberation Army, you know, it was like a revolutionary group and all this kind of stuff. I don't know what happened to that thing. And, my English teachers loved me. They encouraged me to write. I would always write shit. I remember I wrote a story based on the song Rocky Raccoon by the Beatles, but I made a story of it. And my English teacher loved that. But then I also had like early on adversity in that I think at my school, the position of editor of the student paper was elected with like all the other, you know, school committee chairman, all that kind of stuff, class president, everything. So I was elected. Everybody's like, you know, Norman should do it. We're talking about, you know, me and my brother, for those, since people can't see and I'm not using my Negro voice, me and my brother were the only black kids in East Greenwich High School. In East Greenwich, Rhode Island, and the only black kids. And I remember in second grade, I found out later my second grade teacher failed me because I was getting straight A's. She was like, he's cheating. No niggers that smart.
Wow.
So I only found that out later, though, my parents told me. I remember being changed to the seat next to Peter Lund, who was a paste and booger eater and crayon eater and everything like that. We were the only ones in the row. I went from, like, the front row to the back row with Peter Lund. I was like, what the fuck? But that also gave me, like, it backfired, too, because it gave me empathy for the downtrodden. That was, like, the one thing. When it wasn't so bad at the Connecticut school, but when I got to Rhode Island, there was this definite pecking order. And I was just, since I was like the only black kid, I was kind of like trying to be, you know, don't pick on the reds heads. And plus I was in the AP classes. So I was like, don't pick on the nerds. They're my like classmates.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah. So anyways, I got elected to the school paper and as editor. And so it was the year that I got arrested with my mother and my girlfriend, who is white. We were coming home from a Jay Giles concert, and my father's lawyer son.
Jay Giles in like 1976, Providence Civic Center?
Yeah, it was like 73, because I was like 13.
Okay. I was at the one in 76, or 75, so whatever it was.
We got busted because they didn't like Negroes in town, so I made this like satirical story about it on the in the school paper. And they wouldn't let me publish it. And they, like, demoted me and assigned Brian Hatch, who's, you know, I never blamed him because he was another nerd that was a friend of mine. But they assigned him to be co-editor.
Because keep an eye on you.
Yeah, somebody had to, like. And so that sent me towards the radical depths. But, of course, there was, like, you know, we're talking 1973. Vietnam was still going on. So where there was, like, National Lampoon, there was R. Crumb, there was, you know, scads and scads of material. Like, a lot of people, they watch, if they watch that Weather Underground documentary, they talk about how there were like 1,000 bombings a year, terrorist bombings a year in the United States, and they were all like white middle class left wingers, not like crazy Muslims or anything like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, it's true. I just read, I don't know, about a year ago, I read American Pastoral by Philip Roth.
I almost picked that up yesterday.
Really fucking good, man. Check it out. I've always avoided Roth for various reasons, and then
I read one book by him. But.
Yeah, but yeah, so people after he died, people are saying, "Oh, you got to read American." But that's what it's about. It's about a middle class high school girl who gets involved with you know, Weatherman type people. Yeah, yeah.
I read, I think, his last or second to the last one about an affair with a student or an assistant or something like that. It was pretty boring. Wasn't that into it?
Yeah.
Actually, though, the best character in it was his wife. He did a really great depiction of
the surprising. Yeah. Plot Against America is also really great. That's it. You would like that one. That's the fictional or imagined history if Charles Lindbergh had won as president in 1932 instead of FDR.
Huh.
And America, you know, allies with the Nazis and
I tried to read Kushner's book, Rachel Kushner's book that everybody was talking about. What was it called? The Flamethrowers, based on that Greenwich Village apartment blowing up.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But I couldn't get through it. But I did read her previous book, Telex from Cuba, which is about the Cuban Revolution, which I actually liked. So I was like really disappointed that I didn't like her second book. And then the only other thing, these are all recent, was Boyle. T. Karagason Boyle's, no, I can't remember the name of it.
Yeah, he's...
But it was about the hippie commune, and then they go up to Alaska and all this stuff.
Drop City. Yeah. I read that a few years ago.
Yeah,
it's funny. I kind of forgot about him. I loved him, like, in the 80s. I read all his short stories and stuff, then I kind of forgot.
Exactly.
And I was like, hey, T. Corgis and Boyle. Oh, yeah, this looks cool. You know, and I was like, yeah, and it was good. It was like, why didn't I read this guy more often? I don't know.
That was the exact same reason I picked it up, because I was like, oh, I haven't read him forever. And I picked that book up.
That's funny.
And so, yeah, that's where I, you know, then I got, so a lot of that radical literature from every corner of the American left was definitely heavily influential throughout the high school years.
And then at some point you moved to the Lower East Side, which is where we re-met and figured out that we'd known each other as kids. I mean, that was kind of funny.
Well, yeah, because we were like, but there's the other guys, you know, Wexler, Netter, Lewis, because I was living with them.
Right.
And then, and I knew them in school too. And that was always a great thing. I missed when I transferred from Brown to San Francisco Art Institute, because in San Francisco, it was like totally like non-intellectual culture there. But at Brown, those guys, you know, was always, and then back when I moved back in with them in Brooklyn, it was always, and then again, like our little gang there, Darius and Emily and, and the ABC No Rio, Neither Nor Life Cafe crowd. That was like, you know, we were always tag teaming books and like insulting each other and trying to impress Ferris and everything. And, but San Francisco, I couldn't, at the Art Institute, you know, it was just like a bunch of rich, like illiterate kids, you know, those kind of kids that go like, I'm an artist, I don't want to be influenced by anybody else, you know, like what the heck is your problem? Like they know nothing, you know, maybe some of them studied now, but if they're still artists.
Yeah.
But that was like, you know, San Francisco was the low point of my.
I remember that. I remember you really talking about how much you just moved back there like a few months earlier, and you were talking about how much you hated it. And I was like not into New York, and I was thinking maybe I'll move out to San Francisco. And you're like, no, don't do it.
They're all morons. Yeah. And Ronald Reagan.
yeah. And so here I find myself. I've been living north of San Francisco, about 15 miles north of it, for about 12 years now. And I have very mixed feelings, you know. I as I'm getting older, I really like the weather here a lot. That means a lot to me. And I like the outdoor activities, whatever. It's very beautiful here. The air's really clean, usually, except right now it's unbreathable because all of these fucking fires. But you know what? I've never gotten San Francisco, you know. I like, don't spend much time there. You know, It's convenient because there are like if you want the stuff that you can find in a big city, I can go in there and have that stuff available to me. But, you know, I talk to people, oh, man, yeah, this is going on. I don't know. It's never resonated with me somehow.
So. I can never understand how, like, I was paying more rent there than when I got back to New York City. It was cheaper. I was like, what the heck?
Yeah, they're the two most expensive places, I think, in the country.
Anyways, so that's my like early literary literariness. And then, of course, you know.
So who knows? Speaking of like Neither Nor and all that good stuff, somebody was talking about the Anthony Bourdain Lower East Side episode that was on the other day. Did you happen to see that?
No, I haven't watched anything on. I don't know anything about anything.
Yeah. But it was interesting, but people were like, there's somebody on Facebook was all pissed off because, you know, they spoke to, like Richard Hell and John Lurie and, who else, Lydia Lunch and, people like that. And they're like, how come nobody spoke about Neither Nor, and how come nobody spoke about Steve Cannon and the New Yorican Cafe? And, you know, I kind of had to explain to them that, come on, man, the Lower East Side art scene, there were always two very different scenes, right? There was the more like punk rock music scene, and then there was everybody else, right? And the punk rock music scene was always very white. It was not mixed at all. And I was like, you know, those people who went to CBGBs.
The other one was probably, if you're going to center it around music, was probably more jazz and... jazz centered in a sense.
Yeah. But you know, anyway, but Anthony Bourdain even said, like, I didn't, you know, really know the Lower East Side. I came down to see music shows and cop dope, you know. That's the only reason I ever went down there. I never lived there. So I was kind of like, yeah, come on, get over it, guys. There was a snippet of a Richard Kern film on CNN. I thought that was kind of cool, you know.
Yeah.
But, it was like those CBGBs.
Did they have
people.
Him on there?
No, they didn't have him, but they had Lydia. Yeah, I mean, he was on briefly on camera. There was lots of people that we know But I was like, those CBGV folks did not like come over to hear poetry readings at New Yorican Cafe, and I would bet you a dollar that John Ferris never set foot inside CBGB's, maybe once.
He tried to when I got censored at the anti-censorship benefit. Weren't you there?
I think so. Remind me what that was.
It was like a anti-censorship benefit for Jello Biafra's Frankenchrist.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And so they asked Joel Rose. So we all went over there. It was like, I think it was me, you, Joel. I think Emily was there. And then somehow we got outside and they were like, no poets. We're like, Joel's like, what the? And so then it was like, everybody, for some reason, everyone decided I should be the poet. And so you guys didn't come in and I went in. And then I started to read, because I think I had read the poem that I was going to read there. And so it was like intentionally offensive. So
right.
It was like, begins like, my son, my seed, you want to know how to get to a woman's heart? First thing you got to do is use a knife.
Yeah. And then Stefan, I remember people,
prophets jumped up and snatched the mic from it. But all these women were like, we want to hear this. This is true. This is real. You know, he should be reading this. This is like, they couldn't believe it. So we got in a big fight. But I, like, ever since then. So the next time I saw the False Prophets, they played with the Buttholes. They opened up for the Buttholes and I just kept booing them off the stage. I like booed them.
I remember that. This is so funny because just yesterday I interviewed Patrick O'Neill, who is the road manager for the Dead Kennedys, and we're talking about, and your name came up. I said, yeah, my friend Norman, he's like, yeah, remember the False Prophets opened up for you guys? And he's like, oh God. And he's like, yeah, my friend Norman was at the front of the stage saying, fuck you, you suck.
I wouldn't let him get a word in edgewise. I was so pissed at Stefan. But yeah, actually, it was funny because I actually, except for the one woman who worked for CBGB's, she was really pissed at me. But there was like, Pat Griffin was there. I remember her. She's like black woman architect.
I remember her.
Yeah. Married to Hugh Mackey, and they had the motorcycle shop that used to be Neither Nor.
Oh, really? She's married to Hugh Mackey.
Yeah.
He was actually on the Anthony Bourdain special.
Oh, okay.
This is fucking crazy. There's like all these like interwoven. I was saying this to Patrick yesterday. So, and Stefan, so like you were with Dead Kennedys. My friend Norman was there yelling at Stefan, who is the brother of my like freshman year roommate at college. And, it's like, man, this like.
Wishnia?
Yeah. I was like, this is clearly a, we're clearly
That's
living
what
in
it. Wishnia said while I was like screaming and yelling, he was like, you must have gone to Brown University.
And I was like saying, yes, this is just yet more proof that we're living in a computer simulation, and it's just not a very good one. It's like bullshit, terrible algorithms and whatever.
Oh, so those were the main places, though. ABC No Rio, Matthew Courtney, Sunday Night Open Mic, which moved into the anti-folk thing with Latch up there at Sidewalk right. Cafe.
Right.
And then Rick Van Valkenburg and Steve Cannon. Well, no, Rick Van Valkenburg and John Ferris were like the Neither Nor thing. Mikey Pinheiro, Miguel Pinheiro, author of Short Eyes.
Yeah.
All those guys
living in the back room.
Yeah. All those guys were like, and of course, Vazak, Vazak Bar was our like headquarters, the Horseshoe Bar. And I always tell people like, Steve Buscemi and Mark Boone were like the bartenders.
Right.
And everybody's always like, what? But yeah.
Neither Nor was great. I think all the great performances we saw there and some I didn't see there. But strangely enough, that's where a White Zombie got their start.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, they were Lower East Side guys. What's his name? Rob Zombie,
yeah.
Now the terrific horror film maker.
He makes awesome movies.
Yeah, I know. His movies are great.
I love those movies.
Did you see Hereditary by any chance?
No.
Oh, dude, you got to see Hereditary.
Is that the new one?
No, it's not by him, but it's as good as one of his movies or maybe even better. It's just really scary as fuck horror movie. It came out last summer. That's
nice.
Really just about like family dysfunction over generations. Yeah. Yeah, no, check it out. It's great.
Yeah, I couldn't believe a Thousand Corpses. I was just like, what the?
Yeah.
This is amazing.
Yeah, I know.
I think I've seen that movie like 20 times.
And what was the other and one?
The sequel, Devil's Rejects.
Yeah.
And then the Halloween remakes were good too.
Oh, he did those? I didn't even know that.
Yeah, he did like Halloween 1 and 2 remakes.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. I'll check those out.
The second one's not as good, but the first one's really good.
Huh. All right. But all right, do you want to read something for us?
I'm going to read a short story. I've been writing short stories. It's called Half Rabbit, Half Dog. These are like first draft because I started writing the poems on the street.
Oh yeah, let me ask you about that. How long were you doing the street poem stuff? That looked like an interesting idea. You're selling poems on the street.
Yeah, the street poems are like I never was a poet. You know, people always introduce me as a poet. They're like, "He's a poet." I'm like, "I'm not a poet. I'm not even a writer." But they're like, "What do you mean?" I'm like, "I don't make money at it." So I saw this dude I met in Detroit when I was out there, 2014 to 16, and he had an Instagram post where he was doing it, and I was like, "Oh, let me try that." So I did it. I went out with this buddy of mine, young guy, and he hung out for a little bit, took a bunch of pictures, and it was just like, it was fun. But more than like, I actually started off because I was like desperate to get some cash, but then I always had the sign that says, pay whatever you want. It says, you know, it's a sign that says poems, any topic, pay what you will.
Right. And you'd write the poems right there on the spot. Form.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Other guys have. I've seen other ones since now that have. I haven't seen any stands, but I've seen pictures. They I think it's called Poetry on Demand. That's what we are called.
Huh.
But, you know, it's another reason that I probably don't like to talk politics anymore because, you know, you got to be open. You got to, people come up. And I told somebody, you know, who they want. They want. You know, poems about love, about weddings, about their kids, about their pets. And they're like, no political poems. And I was like, no, well, thank God, no. Because I get in like fights. And it makes me like have to try not to be corny and open up to these people. Like you open up to strangers and then they're like people, even if you don't, people that just go by, like even if they don't stop to get a poem. Just to see a guy there with like a typewriter, manual typewriter and a little table and like a sign says poems, you know, it like brightens up people's day. And, you know, it's like maybe one of the best methods of atonement I've ever come up for from my like years of like, you know, just living on the fringe and feeling like everybody was an idiot, you know, it's kind of like, and then you realize too, like a lot of artists are like, you know, oh, regular people, they don't care about art, you know, they don't care about poetry or anything. But regular people love poetry, you know, they like, they're like so into it. That's who like the customers are because the artists and the poets, they go by and they're like, oh, I could write my own poem, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, look at that bum over there, you know, because artists and writers often think that they're so much smarter and better than everyone else.
Yeah,
and
that's a horrible trap to fall into. It's a horrible.
And then you realize that
worst thing that an artist or writer can do is think they're better than other people. I mean, I knew when I was younger, I thought I was smarter than most people, you know. And as I'm aging, I realize that maybe I'm just like a little less dumb than most people, you know.
But I got no
great lessons to teach anybody, you know.
Yeah. You know, but that's that attitude of, you know, I had it. I'm not going to deny, you know, it's like, you know, nobody likes my writing because they're all a bunch of morons, you know, and like nobody thinks like me because they're idiots. And it's like, you know, but then you write a poem for people and it's still your thoughts, you know, and then give it to them. And, you know, the guy's a you know, Facebook programmer, you know, just anything, you know. They got kids, they got families, it's like people I would have called L7, you know, like definitely 20 years ago. And I love it, you know. And one of the great things is, like, you know, I have to, anecdotally, I haven't been taking the numbers, but, you know, women and children, you know, those are definitely the instigators, but there are still a lot of men that come up without any women in there, don't want a poem to give to their girlfriend to, like, ease, you know, like, but a lot of guys will come up too, and they're, like, really curious, you know, they'll talk. In fact, if I have conversation for a long time, it's usually with guys, you know, but in terms of, like, people coming up and wanting a poem, it's often, like, little kids will be like, "Mom, I want a poem," you know?
Oh, that's so kind sweet. Of fun.
I wrote one this week called The Ponysaurus. Kid was like 5-year-old. He's like, "I want a poem about a ponysaurus."
Ah. You came to the right place, kid.
What do you got there? Give me that lollipop. So that got me, and I otherwise, the reason I wasn't a poet before, you know, it's pretty much true with stories too, and essays, as you know, and others who ask for essays from me know, you know, I take forever to write, because not because I take forever to write, but because I take forever to, like, rewrite.
Yeah.
That word, no, oh, what word should I put?
yeah, it's so torturous.
I write like 4 poems a year, you know, but now I got like about 2 years of like street poems. I got like about 500 poems. They're not all good, obviously, but, you know, maybe 20 of them are.
Yeah.
And even though, and it is, it's like I get hugs from kids. One of the best things was a mom I was at the market upstate in Delaware County. And, a mom came to me second week in a row with her kids. And after they got their poem, she's turned back and she was like, "Thank you so much. They've been writing poems every day." I was like, oh, that was like so awesome. And then there's great. Like little kids that give me hugs. Like this one little girl, she like ran back and gave me this hug. You know, she's like 8 years old, you know, got a little tear in my eye. And then some big redneck trucker did that too. He wanted a poem for his daughter. And he was like, "Oh," he goes, "this is great. She'll love this." And then he paused and he looked and he's like, "I love this." And then he was like, "I think I'm going to cry."
Oh,
stupid guy like me. He was like big white, old white dude with a trucker hat on, you know.
That's great.
Totally upstate.
But I think you're right. Most people do like poetry, and most people, you know, it's got to keep going. Got to keep putting this stuff out there, you know.
Yeah, and it isn't to prove like I'm a genius. Like, in fact, my new thing is like, I think I want to do, and I'm putting this out there, I'm going to say this on podcast because I think other people should do it, is you should, you know, people, they should go out on the street. Even if they don't go out to write poems, we should have like, I guess the word is flash mob, but not flash, but like, you know, like
spontaneous
New Year's Day
meetings outside or.
Like, yeah, like just get a bunch of people, you know. Poets with their own poetry, people who have a poem they like, and like stand on a street corner one day and like just, you know, people just like read poems, you know, all afternoon, Saturday afternoon. It's like people will come and listen. They love it. It's like, it's a total.
That's a great idea. Maybe I'll do something like that out here.
Yeah, you should organize something. Definitely.
Yeah.
You know, like just people, like I said, this doesn't have to be poets reading their own poems. It could be people reading, you know, whatever. But so anyways, that got me stories that I'm just doing in one draft.
All right.
And really short. So I got a short story. It's called Half Rabbit, Half Dog. There's a lot of curse words in it, but we've already used a bunch, so I'm not gonna. Half Rabbit, Half Dog. Sorry about that. Half Rabbit, Half Dog. We saw each other every day and every night for years. I had a slew of names I called Lana, Lonnie Pants, and Land Rover, and Lana Bonana, and Lonnie Punani, and Lanky Master, and 1,000 other things I came up with for no reason other than to keep smiling and laughing like fun was a crime and we were rebels without a care. Of course, we were so careless, things turned reckless long before we both knew we had to be careful. I never said so, and neither did she, but you know there was other motherfuckers talking much and making big shit. Fuck 'em, she said, and I said so too. At a bonfire night outside town, Damien got loud about Lana. She stood up from the log a bunch of other people were also sitting on, passing whiskey and weed. She said, fuck this shit, and started for the house. Damien pointed at her and howled. When he stopped, an owl hooted from the trees standing around the edge of the big pond. Bobby said, fucking owl. The coyotes got to yelping on cue, much farther away. Fucking coyotes, roared Damien. Lana stopped and turned and yelled, fucking bitch, fuck you, you fuck. Peepers and crickets and snap crackling wood was the only sound. Then Marissa said, damn. I found Lana in the kitchen in the house. A fire was glowing in the living room fireplace where Jasmine and Jake were making out and finger-fucking like teenagers. I walked past and sat across from the bestie. Motherfucker, she said, what the fuck? I rubbed my eyes with the heels of my palms for as long as it took to feel like my head felt different inside than when I started. When I stopped, finally, Lana was looking at me quizzically and said, what the fuck was that about? On top of a swivel and crane of the neck for emphasis, and without missing a beat, asked, is there any whiskey? I shrugged at the same time as Jake must have come up for air in the living room to say, you freeloaders better leave the parents' liquor alone. They'll be pissed. Lana's jaw dropped and her eyes went saucer size, and probably her muscles got tight since tight and loose like a slingshot. Rubber band action, because she sprang out her seat after it seemed she crouched over Jake. I'm gonna read that sentence again. Lana's jaw dropped and her eyes went saucer size, and probably her muscles got tight and loose like a slingshot rubber band action, because she sprang out her seat after it seemed she crouched over Jake. Jasmine knocked outstretched cold on the Oriental or Persian between the ottoman and the dilapidated Davenport, looking like Vampirella from the back, the way her feet planted on his thighs. She curled her neck around the corner of his head and snarled and lunged and shook until she tore away and whipped her skull and tresses back to display a bloody chin under her toothy grin, snapped fast on a gob of flesh like a freed, happy jackrabbit. Jake keened like a banshee with one hand clapped over the bloody gushing, and land shark bounded out under the bright harvest half moon to wait at the car, where she spat the top chunk of his ear in her palm like it was pirate's booty, red and white blotch for me to see. You can imagine it didn't end well with a call to the cops and a knock on our door opening to four uniformed and armed people between me and Jake's bandaged head. But Lana was never jailed, and there is no end to our friendship of love. For all these years later, tonight we are going out drinking again. That's the end.
All right, man. All right, I like it. I like it. So, all right, I think the hour is just about up. We could keep on yakking for hours more if we wanted to. It's like you said, we barely scratched the surface. I mean, we could have spent an hour telling neither nor stories, probably.
I know.
Yeah. anyway,
we never mentioned Patrick McGrath.
Patrick McGrath.
He's the true luminary who came out of that.
That's true. Patrick McGrath.
Den of Iniquity.
Yeah, yeah. And Pedro Pietri was there.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. All right, man.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.